simple arguments. I would like to welcome students from Lincoln High School in Wisconsin Rapids. Would you stand, please? Don't be shy now. Good. Well, welcome. You're here, as we all know, with the class programs. You may be seated. That is conducted by the court and the state bar. Students have received summaries of this case, and additional summaries are available on the table in the foyer. Now that the court has met, we'd like to introduce the court to you. On my far left is Justice Patrick Crooks. In the empty chair, Justice Jeanine Geske is usually seated there. She is recuperating at home, so she is on a telephone hookup, and she can hear us. Justice Geske, are you there?
I am here. Thank you.
Okay. Justice Geske wishes to ask a question, she will interrupt the proceedings and ask a question. If you cannot hear it, we will repeat it. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. To his right is Justice John Wilcox. And on the far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With the introductions made, I'll call on the last case of the day, 96-0914 CR State v. Hobson. Representing the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Gregory Posner-Weber. Mr. Posner-Weber.
May it please the court. I am Gregory Posner-Weber. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the Wisconsin Department of Justice. I represent the state as the plaintiff appellant in this appeal. At the onset, I would like to thank the court and opposing counsel for their courtesy in rescheduling this argument. The issue on appeal is whether Wisconsin recognizes a common law right to forcibly resist an unlawful arrest. The state of Wisconsin is asking this court for four specific holdings in its decision in this case. First, we are asking this court to abolish the common law position that a citizen may use violent self-help to resist an unlawful arrest. Second, we are asking this court again to hold that when police attempt to arrest a citizen without using excessive force, a citizen has no right to use physical force against the officers. Third, we are asking this court to hold that a citizen who uses such force may be prosecuted and convicted of battery to a law enforcement officer, even if the battery was committed during an arrest later found to be unlawful. And lastly, we are asking this court to reverse the Rock County Circuit Court order dismissing the charge of battery to a law enforcement officer against Shauna Hobson, and to remand the case to Rock County for further proceedings. The traditional common law rule has always been that a person has a right to resist an unlawful arrest short of killing the arresting officer. The state makes two observations at the onset. First, that common law rule has never been expressly accepted or rejected in Wisconsin. And secondly, the common law rule arose out of circumstances that are significantly different from those existing today. The state's position in this litigation has been and will continue to be that the common law right to use violent self-help is a dangerous and discredited legal anachronism.
Well, suppose you just say, I'm not going with you. You just stand firm or you go limp. Is that violent self-help?
No. No, Chief, that would not be violent self-help.
But that would say that the officers could pick you up and take you off, right?
Right. Again, not violence.
So is flailing the hands violent self-help? What's violent self-help? Pointing a gun?
Resisting arrest?
Well, what about, I'm not going.
Either by use of force or threat of use of force.
So if I say I'm going to resist this arrest, that's enough?
The threat of force would be enough.
I'm going to resist this arrest by flailing my hands, feet. That's enough.
Yes.
To be violent, okay.
Yes, which is what happened here. Yes.
Well, the possible excessive police force here was trying to not only take charge of the situation, but to handcuff Mrs. Hobson, right? In other words, could the police have acted in any other manner rather than to have gone to that measure, taking her down to the ground, so to speak, with several officers and then cuffing her?
Almost certainly the police had any number of options available to them in the manner in which they effectuated.
But didn't they choose the most extreme option here?
I don't think they did, Justice Wilcox. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I'm not trained in ways of physically restraining people. It's my understanding from the research that I've done and my own familiarity with these cases. It seems to me that the officers involved here had a reasoned, measured response to what was happening. The record will bear out that Officer Alasankas was trying to put Shona Hobson into a compliance hold, a hold that's designed to prevent the person from resisting. It's also my understanding that handcuffing is standard procedure under these circumstances as well.
They didn't draw guns, did they?
That's not in the record. I don't believe they did.
They didn't use clubs?
The record indicates only the force that I've described. No impact weapons, no chemical weapons, no electric weapons, no firearms.
You suggest that common law right to respond, to resist with force, is dangerous. And then, of course, in the brief, there was discussion of anarchy. It seems to me that if the common law right existed, and I use the conditional if, for the last 300 years, that somewhat belies your concern about anarchy if we affirm the existence of the common law right in Wisconsin.
There is a body of case law, some of it cited by the state, some of it cited by counsel for Ms. Hobson, that refers to situations where individuals used violent self-help and claimed a privilege in so doing. Those cases create a trail of injured police officers, injured passers-by, and injured, frankly, defendants.
Well, let's say that my view of the law is that we have, under Article 1, is it 13? No. 113? We have, of our Constitution, we have the common law right. That section in our Constitution provided that when we became a state, that the existing common law is applicable in the state of Wisconsin. So let's say, for argument purposes, that we have this common law right to resist an unlawful arrest and have had it since the beginning of statehood. So where's the anarchy? Where's the dangerousness? Where's this trail that you depict?
Well, we have an injured police officer in this case, Justice Bradley, Officer Alasankas. We also have a level of risk that was present in this case, in that the 5-year-old boy who was the focus of the initial police response here also became involved in the affray. The record reveals that Officer Alasankas was injured trying to keep this young man out of the arrest situation. I would extend the definition of anarchy to include injuries inflicted upon law enforcement officers, passers-by, and defendants and subjects in arrest situations where the person who was being arrested resisted.
Mr. Weber, do you prefer Posner-Weber?
Posner-Weber.
Posner-Weber. That's all very cold, good legal analysis, but let's assume for the moment that I'm the parent of a really nice, nifty 5-year-old who's a very, very sensitive child, and I know that being the parent. And I know that among other things that upsets her greatly is when her status quo is upset. And I'm there with her, and the police come, and they tell me that they're going to arrest her and take her away. And I know that the very act of doing that, of putting her in a police car without me, is going to greatly upset her, perhaps permanently. What am I supposed to do as a parent?
With the understanding that you are not describing the fact situation that we have in this case, it would seem to me that the reasonable thing to do would be to ask if you could accompany your child to the police station if the officer was taking the child into custody. I believe that that offer was extended to Ms. Hobson in this case. I don't think that officer showed ever attempted to separate mother from child in this process. In fact, Officer Schott, I believe the record reveals, made four separate attempts to obtain Ms. Hobson's cooperation in bringing her child down to the police station.
Okay, now we're going to get to the police station. So, the sensitive child and a very sensitive parent going to the police station, what's the officer going to do now? Fingerprint the child?
Under the Children's Code, I think the officer's ability to act and what would happen when the child was taken into custody to be fairly clearly circumscribed. The statute is 48.19 under the old Children's Code and 48.20, which describes precisely what would happen. There would be an interview with an intake worker.
Would the parent be there?
I believe the parent could be there. I don't think that the
need
Children's Code
there.
Specifically says
so the sensitive father says to the kid, says to the people when we get down to the jail, I want to be with my child. And the officer says, no deal. Then what does the parent do?
The parent, I assume...
You're going to read the Miranda to the kid?
If it's a custodial interrogation situation, I imagine that...
You're going to read that to the child, but you're going to give them the Miranda warnings. How long do you think it's going to take to explain it?
With the parent's assistance, probably a few minutes.
Well, I think the parent told the child to keep quiet. Didn't he say keep quiet, or I don't want the child talking to you?
There's different testimony in the record as to precisely what Ms. Hobson said.
All right.
It's clear to me and plainly to this court that there are a number of investigative options that a law enforcement officer can follow, particularly in dealing with children. I will not stand before the court and say that Officer Schott's approach to investigating the theft of this stolen bicycle was an ideal or perfect investigation. It may not have even been the best option under the circumstances. What we are asking for in terms of rules of law, though, I think transcend the fact situation that you're presented with. The ruling that you issue in this case will certainly affect Ms. Hobson, but it will also affect the way that other arrests are conducted and the way that other citizens respond when they are placed under arrest.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Can you think of any situation then? In other words, are we stuck with all or nothing here? In other words, we either abrogate completely and abolish any self-help by the citizen, or on the other hand, we adopt the other position. Is there any halfway point? Can you think of any situation where a citizen might have the right to defend him or herself against an unlawful arrest?
In fairness, I believe that that halfway position was what the circuit court was trying to achieve in this case, and I believe what Attorney Strang put forward in the non-party brief, a suggestion that somehow the common law right would attach in a situation where a family member or a person was placed in the position of being injured and there was no recourse available to that person after the fact to receive vindication, either legal vindication or other vindication. I personally find that option to be unreasonable because, frankly, it is a fairly complicated and complex analysis. I thought that the circuit court really had to strain the common law rule in order to craft this kind of test. In fairness, though, I think that's what the circuit court was trying to do.
Well, certainly being put in extreme physical danger by whatever set of circumstances, do you think that might be one of the exceptions, or do you...
If by that you mean the excessive use of force by law enforcement officers, we have Reinwand and we have Mendoza. We have cases that very clearly stand for the proposition that an individual in that position may make a claim of self-defense against the law enforcement officers in a trial situation. We never had that here. This case never dropped.
That has nothing to do with any common law strike. Is that based on a common law right or rule? Reinwein?
I don't think Reinwein goes on either case on common law.
We're talking statutory defenses of self-defense, legislative-made law.
And, Jura, what section of 4819 was this child taken into custody?
The child wasn't taken into custody. The state's position is that the section that most closely applies, 48.19 sub 1, sub D, sub 3, which would allow an officer to take a child into custody if he has committed or has committed an act which is a violation of a state or federal criminal law. The officer has to have reasonable grounds to suspect that that's the case. This court, I think, has defined reasonable grounds to be probable cause in this context.
3 is gone from 95-96.
It's all been amended, and now under 938, I think the criteria may have changed somewhat, too. This is plainly an old law case, though. I don't think that counsel for Ms. Hobson has contended otherwise.
Is self-defense enter into this at all?
It may have if the judge had allowed it to go to trial. And we discussed that in the context of preparation for this case. Ms. Hobson would have had the opportunity to request affirmative defense instructions on self-defense. The matter could have been put before the jury, and the jury could have decided whether her actions were reasonable and privileged under law. It never got to that point. The circuit court did not allow it to go to trial.
Judge Welker, as you noted, didn't adopt the common law right to resist an unlawful arrest, but rather modified it. He stated, a person has a right to resist an unlawful arrest only where the person's health and safety, or that of a member of his or her family, is placed in jeopardy, so that no adequate vindication can be had in court later. Sounds to me like a pretty narrow application of the common law right. You indicate that's unreasonable. What's unreasonable about it?
Let me first make sure that we're quoting from the same material. Are you reading from the transcript?
I have page 7 of his opinion.
Okay. At page 108 of the appendix, which is page 6 of the written opinion, the judge opines that the superior social policy is advanced by a rule which modifies the common law rule so as to not permit resistance to an unlawful arrest unless the health or safety of the individual or a member of his or her family is threatened in a way that is not susceptible of cure later in the courtroom.
Yeah.
The initial problem I have with that is that it requires the individual to make a decision out in the world as to whether or not an arrest is unlawful. With respect, that's what we pay judges and juries and attorneys to decide.
How is that any different than Reinwein, which requires a person to decide out in the street, so to speak, whether or not the force they're using is reasonable in response to, whether or not they have to determine, the force being applied by law enforcement is excessive. We have those on the street applications and decisions all the time.
In that context, it is the same as Reinwein. However, it goes to a jury. That's why we have the affirmative defense of self-defense. That's why we have statutes that reduce or mitigate criminal liability based on the use of force by one of the actors involved, and that can include a police officer. That is Reinwein and Mendoza. But what we do is entrust courts to make those decisions. We say to the citizens, no, we will not allow you to litigate the lawfulness of this arrest in the street. We will not allow you to do that because the lives of police officers, the lives of private citizens, and the life of the suspect are all very precious to us. They're important to us. And when we allow this litigation to take place on a street corner, we are asking for people to get hurt. We're asking for our police officers to get hurt, and we're asking for our children to get hurt. And I see no sense in that.
Well, counsel, what's different now than it was in common law? You indicated that maybe this rule at common law, as I understand the rule, is that where there's a patently unlawful arrest, that patently unlawful arrest is such provocation that the criminal element in resistance is reduced, if not removed entirely.
That is a statement of the common law, yes.
Okay. So what has changed since the 17th century, which, as I understand it from Paul Chevenin's article, that was the rule. There were exceptions, but, I mean, that's the rule. What has changed? And then I should tell you that the court dealt with State v. Richards this morning, in which the court, U.S. Supreme Court, quoted with approval Justice Scalia's comment that rights of citizens don't depend on changing social conditions, but that they're eternal. Now that I've said that to you, tell me what's so changed.
Thank you.
What's so changed that we shouldn't change, quote, eternal common law rights?
Beyond question, the legal infrastructure has changed from the time period of the common law. We gave you in the state's brief three reasons why you should reject the common law. The first is the change in conditions. I don't know if you want to incorporate that in the social conditions analysis or not. British prisons under the crown were death traps. It was possible to be arrested by a private citizen as well as by a member of the crown. You were just as likely to die awaiting trial as you were to suffer a death sentence at trial. You had no legal recourse to test the legality of the state's arrest, to test the strength of the case before trial. Today, we have a panoply of legal rights that attach upon arrest. We have a judicial infrastructure that allows those rights to be litigated, to be vindicated, both in the context of the individual case, in terms of motions to suppress, in terms of bond, in terms of arraignment, and also to hold law enforcement officers accountable for their actions through either federal litigation, state litigation, or a combination of both. That infrastructure was missing from British jurisprudence at the time that the common law right to use violent self-help arose. That is a fundamental difference in the state's view.
Well, counsel, what I glean from what you're saying is that a parent then, if they believe that no matter how strongly they believe and how correctly they believe that imminent danger is going to befall their child, they have no recourse except to stand aside. If the cop comes in and says, your child, your five-year-old child is under arrest and I'm taking her downtown.
In a situation, and again, it's a hypothetical, but in a situation where...
Well, after this, I can believe just about anything.
Gee. I would hope that a law enforcement officer, when presented with information of the kind that you suggest, a situation where we have a particularly vulnerable child, I would hope that a law enforcement officer might consider all of the alternatives that are available to him or her in investigating an alleged delinquent act.
They didn't hear.
They didn't hear. No, sir, they did not.
So what remedy do you have? I mean, here the trial court dismissed a misdemeanor charge?
Actually, three misdemeanors and a felony.
Okay, dismissed. What was the felony charge?
The battery to a law enforcement officer.
Ah, what's the maximum sentence?
A battery to a law enforcement officer?
It's felony. It's over a year, right?
Yeah, it's either a D or an E. I would have to check.
So it's over a year. So possibility would be a year, right, if we would hold with you. She could be sentenced to a year.
If you hold the way that we're asking you to hold, we would be able to proceed on the battery to a law enforcement officer charge. And that would allow for I think, a five-year prison term?
Five-year prison term. And suppose and it doesn't matter that the police officer didn't have probable cause, ultimately. Wouldn't have mattered. That's not a defense.
Our position is that if you batter a law enforcement officer during an arrest, you should be held accountable for that.
Right, regardless of whether the arrest. So how is the police officer held accountable?
A police officer could be held accountable in a civil action in federal court under Section 1983. It would also be possible, I believe, if there was some reason to think that the municipality somehow bore liability, they would be a possible target of litigation. If the officers involved committed crimes, during the actual arrest. They could be held accountable in state court on state charges. The Rodney King episode in California also makes very clear that federal prosecutions, criminal prosecutions, can take place. There are a number of different alternatives that are available, apart from any vindication that takes place in the context
of internal police discipline, I assume.
And internal police discipline.
Mr. Posner-Weber, let me ask you a question, if I might. Let's assume that, indeed, the common law right exists in Wisconsin right now. You've asked that we reverse the trial court and remand, and obviously modify this rule or abrogate the rule. Don't you think there's an ex post facto problem if we do that?
Our position is that since no Wisconsin court, no appellate court, this court in particular, never expressly adopted or rejected the common law rule, the ex post facto analysis really does not apply.
Isn't that really a difficult position for us to accept, given the language of Article 14, Section 13 of the Wisconsin Constitution?
If you accept the proposition that the legislature, by specifically creating affirmative defenses, and one of those affirmative defenses being the right to claim self-defense, I think you can make the argument that the legislature has already acted, assuming the common law privilege existed in Wisconsin. In the judicial in the statutory revisions in the 1950s, affirmative defenses were created and specified, including self-defense. The legislature may already have acted to abrogate any common law privilege that exists. I'm in the right.
Thank you, Mr. Posner-Weber. Mr. Finley, you're representing Ms. Hobson. You're from the Remington Center at the law school.
That's correct. Thank you.
The court asked you to take this case, you and the public defender who filed an amicus. Is that correct?
That is correct. The court asked if we would be willing to represent
Ms. Hobson. And you reached Ms. Hobson and you represent her?
Yes, we do represent her. We reached her. She asked us to represent her, and we were appointed by the public defender's office.
Okay.
Thank you. Shauna Hobson came to her front door to find her 5-year-old child fleeing from a stranger who was trying to force that child into the back seat of his car. That stranger, of course, was a police officer, but he was attempting to unlawfully arrest and interrogate that 5-year-old child.
Was he in uniform?
Yes, he was. Shauna Hobson did what I think any of us as parents or grandparents would do under those circumstances. And in fact, what the Wisconsin statutes say she must do. She acted to protect her child from the emotional harm that was about to be done to that child.
What statute is that, Mr. Finley?
948.04 sub 2, which creates a felony if a parent fails to protect a child from emotional harm. Surely just about any one of us would have been similarly shocked and similarly determined to protect our children. I think really few would allow anyone to cart off our preschoolers under these circumstances. Justice Babbage, I would suggest to you that not just a particularly sensitive 5-year-old, but just about any 5-year-old that I've been familiar with would find this to be an extremely traumatizing and emotionally damaging experience.
What about a sensitive 10-year-old? Is there some break on this that age makes a difference?
I suppose a sensitive 10-year-old could be harmed by this as well, but at that point we're aided by the legislature's determination under Chapter 938 that a 10-year-old can be charged with a delinquency. So I think we have a legislative determination at least to draw the line there. I might also point out that the common law helps us a little bit there also, and that is that at common law, a child under the age of 7 was deemed to be incapable of forming criminal intent. So I think that helps us also understand what's going on here.
The intent here was to permanently deprive an owner of property.
That's right.
Theft.
That's right, because another child said he was riding a bicycle that didn't belong to him. So Shauna Hobson responded, I think, in the only way that any parent reasonably could be expected to react here. She told the police not to subject her preschooler to custodial interrogation. And she answered the police officer's questions about the bike, should have resolved the problem then and there, but then she told them to leave her child alone. And the officers then responded. 5 police officers then unlawfully and forcefully grabbed her, tried to twist her arm into a painful compliance hold, tackled her, and handcuffed her. The issue before this court today is whether the state, having thus violated her rights in this way, can punish her again for trying to protect her child. 300 years of common law wisdom tell us the answer to that question, and that answer is the one that was given by Judge Welker in the trial court when he dismissed this case because it would be unjust to add criminal punishment to Ms. Hobson for having reacted reasonably and justifiably to defend her young son and herself against blatant and harmful police illegality.
But isn't that the function of a jury, not a judge, in dismissing the case? And I'm reading from a New Jersey court. Find this appealing. The concept of self-help is in decline. It is antisocial in an urbanized society. It is potentially dangerous to all involved. It is no longer necessary because of the legal remedies available. We really don't want people resisting arrest. Do we, even if the arrest is unlawful?
It seems to me that that argument misperceives both the reason and the effect for the common law rule. The common law rule is not designed to encourage citizens to resist violently in the streets. And in fact, it really doesn't have that effect because nobody knows. A citizen confronted with illegal police conduct doesn't know what the law is and doesn't take the moment to contemplate, to figure out whether what's going on is legal or not, what their rights are. To resist the police is the work of the moment. Instead, what this rule is all about is two things. One, it's reinforcing a very fundamental, important political doctrine, which is that citizens have the rights of liberty against the state. And the other is that it's recognizing that when police act unlawfully to detain a citizen and do so in a way that's blatantly illegal, that is a provocation that a reasonable and citizen might justifiably react to, and that therefore it is unfair to punish that citizen for having reacted fairly, reasonably, and justifiably to that police provocation. The rule has nothing to do, really, with regulating primary conduct in the confrontations between citizens and police because it won't have any effect. It surely couldn't have had any effect in this case. Ms. Hobson didn't know whether this court had accepted or rejected the common law rule, and if she had known, it would not have changed the way in which she responded. It does not affect her primary conduct. Instead, what it does is it tells us that now that she's reacted, because the police acted so unlawfully, and she reacted to try to defend herself and her child, it's simply unjust to then punish her for having reacted reasonably and justifiably to that provocation.
Chief?
And so, I'm sorry.
Justice Geske has a question.
Chief, yes. I'd like to ask whether our court has ever recognized a common law affirmative defense subsequent to the enactment of the statutory affirmative defenses by the legislature.
Did you understand that?
I'm not sure I heard all of that.
Justice Geske asked, and you will correct me if I misstated. Has our court ever recognized a common law affirmative defense subsequent to the adoption of the statutes which do set forth a series of defenses? Is that your question, Justice Geske?
That's right. That's the question.
That's the question.
To be honest, I'm not sure.
Well, I'll give you a case. State v. Brown, which was a case that involved a person getting a ticket, and the defense was kind of entrapment necessity, because the youngster who was 16 was driving the car to the Supreme Court to deliver a brief. A father who was late in filing a brief alleged that he was being chased by a car, and to protect his sister, who was a passenger, he sped on the I-90 system, and the defense was recognized.
Thank you, Chief.
You're welcome. Any time, Justice.
And I thank you as well.
Guess who the author was?
Can we vote on that?
But what this question, I think, also raises is really whether, in fact, this is a part of the common law in Wisconsin, and I think the answer to that is quite clearly yes. Article 14, Section 13 of the Wisconsin Constitution incorporates the common law, and therefore it really makes no difference whether this court or any appellate court in this state has expressly adopted or rejected this rule, because the Constitution, by its very words, adopts this rule by adopting the common law. And the common law that the Constitution adopted, as this court has said many times, was the common law as it existed in England at the time of the American Revolution. This rule was indisputably an established part of that common law. The Wisconsin Constitution makes it a part of Wisconsin's law as well. In addition...
Mr. Finley, let me interrupt you for a minute. We've had quite a history over the last 15 or 20 years in Wisconsin of organizations like the Posse Comitatus. If indeed you're correct, and let's assume that you are, that our Constitution recognizes this right, if we now as a court put our imprimatur on it and indicate this is indeed a right of citizens, are we not going to encourage groups like the Posse Comitatus to take the law into their own hands?
No, I don't think so, and for at least two reasons. One reason being, this court has already, in the Gibbs case, indicated in a written decision that this is a part of the common law. Now, that was not a holding, but it certainly was a statement by this court recognizing that rule. In addition, the United States Supreme Court, as early as the late 19th century, and for some decisions after that, expressly recognized the common law right. Yet we don't see, if any court is going to put its imprimatur on this rule that might have an effect, you'd think the United States Supreme Court saying so might have that effect. Yet it really hasn't. The other reason that I think that doesn't have that effect, and it's something I really have to respond to in the state's reply brief when they raise this specter of G. Gordon Liddy and the Posse Comitatus, is whatever they think they're justified in doing in responding to police in unlawfulness doesn't matter. It's not a test as to what the Posse Comitatus thinks is appropriate or reasonable. It's not a test that looks to what G. Gordon Liddy thinks is appropriate or reasonable. It's not a test that looks to what Shauna Hobson thinks is appropriate and reasonable. It's an objective reasonableness standard. And that is a determination that must be made in a court of law. This rule does not take the decision from the courts and move it to the streets.
Are you satisfied with the modification to the common law rule that Judge Welker made in this case?
I think that the accommodation that Judge Welker made in this case is a reasonable and appropriate resolution of this matter. I don't think it's a stretch whatsoever from the common law rule. Instead, I think what Judge Welker did was he really honed in on the core values of the common law rule. Because remember, this rule is about protecting citizens who respond reasonably to provocation. But when is the provocation the most serious? When is response most reasonable? It's when irremediable harm is going to be done to you. That's what the common law rule is most used for, and that's what Judge Welker applied it to in this situation. This is a case where there are no post hoc remedies could possibly remedy the situation. I'm just going to say that telling a mother that she can sue the police later, that the police can be disciplined, or after her child has already been subjected to station house interrogation, is little remedy at all.
Well, now look, suppose I'm walking down the street and we're in the same kind of scene and there's a stolen bicycle and I see the bicycle on the sidewalk and I pick it up and try and ride it and the officer comes and attempts to arrest me because it's been reported that a woman with roughly my description walked away with the bicycle. Now, I didn't do anything other than being a good citizen, picking up that bicycle, not moving it anywhere, just leaning it against the lamppost. It's outrageous that I'm arrested. And I've got other things I want to do that afternoon rather than call my lawyer from jail. And suppose I am terribly provoked by this. I mean, I've lost all reason. I say, no, I'm not going with you. I mean, this is ridiculous, etc. And so all of a sudden there are five officers and I'm down on the floor being, quote, contained, unquote. Do I have a common law privilege?
Under the common law rule in its pure form, yes, you do, I believe, if in fact the arrest was unlawful.
Well, but you know, that... I mean, I may have been adequately provoked, and the officer may be just wrong, but it just doesn't seem as if we want to run a society where an officer in good faith thinks that I am the culprit, makes the arrest in good faith. Now he's got, or she's got, a person who's out of control, and these things escalate, right? And the officer doesn't know that I'm not going to grab her gun and shoot. All she knows is that she's got to deal with a person who is resisting. You don't expect that officer to just say, "Pardon me, lady, I'm sorry I bothered you." I don't see how recognizing this common law doctrine can help society or help law enforcement that already has a difficult job and a dangerous job.
Yes, it does. And first off, of course, this case doesn't go anywhere near that, and we can affirm the trial court's ruling without adopting the pure form of, or without continuing the pure form of the common law rule. But addressing your hypothetical, it seems to me, you're right, we don't want citizens to fight back if they have other recourse. But again, implicit in that is the notion that adopting or rejecting or abrogating the common law rule will somehow affect how the citizens
respond. Oh, I'm going to read in the newspapers and hear on the TV and listen to the radio and hear about that if it's an unlawful arrest, I don't have to go. I can put up reasonable.
But then again, and that's the key, reasonable force. It doesn't mean you can draw a weapon. It doesn't mean you can gratuitously assault the police officers. It means reasonable force. You can use reasonable force to defend yourself. And what the rule is really about is saying, if you were in the right and the police were in the wrong, we don't necessarily want you to fight back. But if it turns out in a court of law, it's determined later that you were in the right and they were in the wrong, what justice is there in then punishing you for having been in the right?
So your position is, I can fight reasonably. They can contain me reasonably. They can take me down to the police station reasonably. I may win at the preliminary or the final hearing and be free because I was reasonable and they were wrong. That's your position.
Under the pure form of the common law rule, that's correct.
And I can sue the police for an unlawful arrest.
Yes.
But Mr. Findley, what is reasonable? I mean, doesn't reasonable depend on who wins on the street? I mean, it might, in order for the officers to finally get that person under control, they might reasonably have to use a great deal of force. And in order for the individual who believes his or her rights are being violated, that this is an unlawful arrest, in order to avoid it, reasonable force may start off to be somewhat kind of resisting, and later may only, in order to succeed, it may necessitate the use of a weapon.
Yes, it's the same type of reasonableness analysis that goes into any self-defense question that courts and juries make decisions about all the time. This is really very little than pure self-defense. We don't have self-defense because we want to encourage citizens to fight back when the mugger comes up and demands their money.
But Mr. Findley, if we write an opinion that says that a person has the right to use reasonable force to resist an unlawful arrest, it seems to me we've written a blank check.
I don't think that's true at all.
What is reasonable in my eyes may be, or what is unreasonable in my eyes may well be very reasonable to somebody else on that street who reads this and says, "Oh, I've got the right to use reasonable means to resist this unlawful arrest." And they may believe that any time they're going to be taken into custody, it's unreasonable or unlawful because they never did anything wrong. I mean, now we're in
But it's for the court to decide what's reasonable, not the citizen. And besides, I'm not asking you to write any such rule like that. I'm asking you to affirm the trial court.
Okay, what is it exactly that you're asking us to affirm?
I'm asking you
What words of the trial court?
Mr. Posner-Weber read the decision of the trial court. Now, that may have been restricted in one sense that I think is unnecessary, and that is that the court limited it to imminent danger or harm to an immediate family member.
A citizen has the right to resist an unlawful... I'm reading from page 7. Are these the words? A citizen has the right to resist an unlawful arrest only where the person's health and safety or that of a member of his or her family is placed in jeopardy so that no adequate vindication can be had in court later.
That is all I need in this case. That's a reasonable rule to me, except that I think that perhaps, probably to limit it to immediate family members is too restrictive. If you look at the rule law of the statutory defense of self-defense, you can defend any third person, and there's no reason to limit it to immediate family members. If it's a necessary measure to help anyone, you ought to be privileged to do that. I'm not saying this is what you should do. I'm saying this is fine with us. This, it seems to me, goes to the essence of the rule. It goes to the core values of it. This is the most important part to salvage. You can go farther than that and still have a reasonable rule, I think. But at least we have to go as far as Judge Welker went.
Well, then, my example, I wouldn't have the right to resist.
Because and your health, example, no.
My health and safety were not threatened. I had other things I wanted to do that afternoon.
That's right.
So I would not have had it. So if my health was threatened because I was on the way to the hospital or I couldn't stand being cooped up for some reason or other.
Or if there was a lynch mob waiting and you knew that the sheriff was in cahoots. I mean, there are things, whatever. There might be other circumstances, or as in the facts of this case, where the harm that's going to be done by the arrest itself cannot be remedied.
So you want us to limit our decision to the facts of this case? In other words, are you... I know that about 37 states have abrogated either by judicial or statutory law the common law right to effectively fight or debate an unlawful arrest. Your position seems to me to be one that you're saying, well, only in this type of circumstance would a person have a right to avoid an unlawful arrest.
I'm saying that's acceptable to me because I represent Shauna Hobson, and that seems to me to be a reasonable rule, and that affirms the trial court decision. I'm also saying that I think you can affirm a broader rule than that and have a reasonable rule, but you don't need to go that far.
Let's take that. You're saying in this case, in the facts of this case, it's your position that, as I understand it, that there was unreasonable force by law enforcement. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Then I don't understand why you even need this common law rule. Because you have Rhinewind, which already gives you the rule that, as you do self-defense by statute, that a person has a right under Rhinewind to resist forcibly any, and I'm now substituting a word, excessive force, which I think is the same as unreasonable force that you just conceded. So you have Rhinewind, don't need the common law rule. So why didn't you just go under Rhinewind?
I think you've hit on something very important, and that is right. That you're absolutely right. This is entirely consistent with the statutory framework of law that we now have. And so I think that the question is turned around backwards, though. And the question is, how can we possibly then abrogate the rule to the extent that it was applied in this case when it is even the law mandated by statute?
But we don't even... You don't need to argue, do you, whether or not the common law right exists in the state of Wisconsin, whether or not it should be abrogated, whether or not the abrogation constitutes ex post facto. Why are you arguing that? Why don't you just say, look, this is the case already, well recognized in Wisconsin. You have the right to resist with reasonable force when law enforcement is using unreasonable force. We already have that.
That's a perfectly acceptable formulation. I do think
what's the unreasonable force in this case?
Well,
they didn't manhandle the kid.
That I think highlights one of the problems with the state's formulation of the test when they say that the only force, the only time one can defend oneself is when police use excessive force. Well, what's excessive force? The police didn't have any authority to do anything in this case, so any application of force arguably then is excessive force. That's the problem you get into in that formulation. And so maybe it makes it more clear than to speak of it in the terms the trial court spoke of it and to say, well, forget about whether it was excessive force or whatnot. Let's look to whether the police had the lawful authority to do what they did. And if they didn't, then we recognize that a citizen can defend oneself, and in the trial court's formulation of it, at least where there is no other remedy that can be had later that will suffice in court. So it seems to me that this rule really is entirely consistent with the statutory law we have, but that it clarifies it. It helps remove an ambiguity as to whether or not, as to how you define excessive force, and makes it clear that just because police officers are acting even ostensibly in good faith, that that doesn't mean that the citizen can never defend himself or herself. This is really, I think, a subspecies of self-defense. It's a clarification of it for a specific context, and it's useful in that sense. And mind you, it is a rule that has coexisted, of course, in the common law with the general defense of self-defense. It has been found useful in this specific context, probably for that reason, even though the common law has both self-defense and the right to resist unlawful arrest.
Mr. Finley, why do you think there's an ex post facto problem here?
Well, I think there's an ex post facto problem here because, as the state agrees, Article 14, Section 13 of the Wisconsin Constitution incorporates the common law. I was going to say earlier, we also have a statutory incorporation, and that's Section 939.10 that preserves all statutory rules of criminal procedure and some of the literary works explaining that make clear that that includes common law defenses. So we have a statutory provision in addition that expressly incorporates defenses such as this. And then we also have another statutory provision, 939.45, that establishes common law privileges as a defense to crimes. It says that privilege is a defense to a crime, and that includes statutory defenses and, statutory privileges and common law privileges. So we have many indications in the Constitution and in our statutes that these common law rules were incorporated. They became a part of the law. Well, the ex post facto principles tell us then very clearly that if you had a defense at one time, and then there's a change in the law, even a change announced by a court, that takes away that defense, that is an ex post facto application. And under the Due Process Clause, you cannot remove a defense to a crime that existed at the time that the incident occurred. The ex post facto violation, it seems to me, is there's absolutely no way around it. It's just irrefutable.
Why was the arrest of Mrs. Hobson unlawful? That's the arrest that you're referring to as the unlawful arrest, correct? The arrest of Mrs. Hobson, not of the boy.
Well, the attempt to arrest the child was unlawful, and then then her attempts to stop that then created the next arrest, and that was also unlawful. Let me take it from the beginning.
Yeah, I've asked you why. I didn't ask you that.
I'm sorry?
Why is it unlawful? You're giving me a conclusion, but I need some reason.
Yes, I want to tell you about that. The arrest of the child is unlawful. The attempt to take the child into custody for interrogation is unlawful because under Chapter 48, the Attorney General has cited one provision, but he hasn't given you everything that's really important. Section 48.19.1(d)(3) is the one that says that an officer may take a child into custody if they believe that the child has committed a crime. But then Section 48.20 sub 2 sub AG goes on to provide that the person taking the child into custody shall make every effort to release the child immediately to the child's parent, guardian, or legal custodian, which means you can't arrest a child who's in the custody of the mother to turn around and give him right back to the mother. What sense does that make? The statutes clearly are indicating that you can't arrest a child who's 5 years old. Moreover, the trial court found that there wasn't probable cause in this case and that the police were unlawfully attempting to detain this child to force some interrogation, and that's plainly unlawful. Then you move to the next step. You can't arrest the mother for saying, no, I won't let you talk to my child. Remember, that's all that she did. She said to the police, you can't talk to my child. And that's when they arrested her for obstructing. Well, even if all they wanted to do was ask the child questions, she had a right to invoke his right to silence. They didn't have any right to insist on taking the child. She did absolutely nothing wrong in telling them they couldn't talk to the child. They were acting, therefore, without lawful authority when they demanded to see the child, and lawful authority is a requirement for the obstructing charge. Under the law of obstructing and resisting, it's not obstructing or resisting to refuse to cooperate if the police are not acting with lawful authority. This was blatant police illegality. At its really worst, it's shocking to believe that this day and age, a police officer would think he can arrest a five-year-old over another child's dispute about a toy. I mean, we give children timeouts. We don't arrest them at 5 years old. I don't know. Did that answer your? I hope that answered your question. There is another basis, of course, upon which the court can affirm the trial court. There are a couple of others. One is that the police misconduct in this case was so outrageous as to violate due process norms, and that is clearly a question of law that can be decided before trial. And that's a very narrow defense, but that one is one that is clearly established, that's been recognized by the courts in this state. It has very narrow application, but it is one that really does apply here. This is one of those rare circumstances where the police conduct just went too far, and where it would be grossly unjust to allow a prosecution to proceed. This is a case where the police created a no-win situation for this mother. They really presented her with a Hobson's choice here. They told her, on the one hand, you either comply with our demand and turn your child over to us so that we can interrogate this child unlawfully and subject him to this harm, thereby requiring her to violate her own obligation to her child and to commit the crime of failing to protect a child from emotional harm. That was her one choice. Or on the other hand, you can refuse to cooperate and we will arrest you for obstructing and resisting. That's no choice at all. And the due process clause absolutely tells us that it's unfair. You cannot prosecute a citizen when they're backed into a corner like that where they can do nothing but commit a wrong. So for those reasons as well, and others presented in the brief, we ask that you affirm the ruling of the of Judge Welker in the circuit court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Finley. Mr. Posner-Webb.
Mr. Findlay tells you that the common law does not and will not regulate primary conduct in this state. This court is probably aware of the fact that on Sunday, December 14th, in a banner headline in an above-the-fold article, the State Journal described in detail the case that's being argued here today. Plainly, if this court decides that there is a common law right to resist, to use violent self-help, to resist an unlawful arrest, that matter will become known. This matter got press attention at the time. There was an article in the March 14th, 1997 Milwaukee Journal when this case was offered for certification. There was also an article in the January 3rd, 1996 edition of the Beloit Daily News.
Counsel?
When Judge Welker dismissed this cause.
Counsel, you started your comments today asking that we abolish the common law that citizens may use violent self-help to resist, etc. In your brief, you used the term abrogate. Both of those statements imply that the common law right exists. You don't abolish something that doesn't exist. You don't abrogate something that doesn't already exist. I look at your brief, I look at the law, the Bone case that refers to Article 14, Section 13. It seems when you have Article 14, Section 13, when you have the Bone case that says the common law received in Wisconsin by virtue of that constitutional privilege is the law arising from English decisions, and that, you know, we have that now. So your language suggests that it exists. The Constitution suggests that it exists. Case law suggests that it exists. Why do you stand here before the court and say it doesn't exist in the state of Wisconsin?
We chose the word abrogate in drafting the brief because the circuit court, in deciding this case, stated that the common law right existed under Wisconsin law. We disagree with that. Both the legislature and the U.S. Constitution, the state constitution, excuse me, address the retention of common law principles. Article 14, Section 13 of the Constitution says that those parts of the common law that are now in force are incorporated in until altered or suspended by the legislature. The legislative reference also talks about those common law principles that are not inconsistent with other provisions of chapters 939 to 951. Our position is that when the legislature spoke in creating the affirmative defenses that involve self-defense, when the legislature created statutes that mitigate levels of guilt based on uses of force, the legislature basically co-opted, changed, eliminated, vitiated, whatever term you want to use, the common law right to violent self-help. Plainly, the legislature acted in so doing when it created these affirmative defenses that speak to the question of when someone can use force to defend oneself and avoid criminal liability for
it. But is that inconsistent with the common law?
I believe it is. I believe it is. I believe that the legislature, when it specified those areas and those crimes in which the use of force either reduces the level of criminal liability or excuses liability entirely, plainly that's inconsistent with a sweeping common law right to use violent self-help. I think the legislature has decided this issue insofar as whether we have a common law right in Wisconsin.
Counsel, are you finished answering Justice Bradley's question? You heard my question to Mr. Finley with respect to the unlawfulness of the arrest of the juvenile and the unlawfulness of the arrest of Mrs. Hobson. Did you agree or disagree with those answers? If you disagree...
I think Mr. Finley's wrong in his construction of the Children's Code. I think Officer Show definitely had a basis under the Children's Code as it existed then to take this child into custody. It may well have been that it would have been a short term of custody. It may well have been that the child would have been returned to the mother very quickly. But plainly, under the Children's Code, he had the right to take her into custody. We conceded, for purposes of this argument, that there was no probable cause to arrest Ms. Hobson either for disorderly conduct, resisting, or obstructing. We conceded those points so that we could place this more important issue before the court, whether or not there is a...